There's lots and lots of research that shows you that firms that have a purpose do better than firms that don't have a purpose. Just think about it in basics. If you come to work in the morning and you don't know what the purpose is, you're not going to be running a very good company. So if the company has a purpose, if that purpose is clear and it's well articulated and there's metrics that lead you to that purpose, those organizations perform better. That's kind of easy. What we look at the course, the word purpose is an amorphous word. It means lots of things to different people. We're looking at firms that not only have a purpose, but are trying to attack a massive societal problem through the vessel of a firm. So your purpose could be to build a better fountain pen. That's a fine purpose, and the better you articulate that purpose, probably the better pen you'll build. We're not talking about those firms. We're talking about firms and leaders in particular, individuals who have said there's a problem out there. And the clearest one is climate change. There's lots and lots of ways to, as an individual, to attack climate change. We're looking at these particularly audacious and possibly crazy people who say, I'm going to try and attack climate change at scale. And I'm going to create a firm. And we're looking at what it takes to actually make that happen. And these are not meant to be happy fairy tales, because it's tough.
Welcome. I'm your host, Dino Cattaneo, and you're listening to Authentic Leadership for Everyday People, the podcast where we investigate the connection between effective leadership and authenticity. If you're looking for inspiration and tips on how to become a better leader by being your true self, you're in the right place. Today is the second episode on the topic of business and societal change. Last week, we had a solo episode where I shared some considerations on how to tackle the question of whether a leader or a company should take a position on specific societal issues. As I had already announced in that episode, today I am joined by Deb Spar, former president of Barnard College and currently a senior dean, a professor, and the head of the Business and Global Society Unit at Harvard Business School. She's here to discuss a new course that she designed and oversees. It's called The Social Purpose of the Firm. It's a relative new class since it launched only 2 years ago, but it is required in the first-year curriculum of the MBA program at the school. In our conversation, we discuss the origin of this course, why it is important that all students go through it, and what the objective of the class are. We also talked about purpose-driven businesses, companies that aim to tackle large societal problems while also generating a profit. Deb delved into some of the unique characteristics of these businesses and the people who start them and join them. Finally, since she's seen firsthand some of the brightest members of Gen Z who are about to enter the workforce, we talked about what makes that generation unique and wonderful and why it gives her great hope for the future. Enjoy the show. So Deb, it's great to have you back here. I will put in the note of the episodes a link to the previous time that you came here. I'm really thankful that you agreed to come and talk about a topic that is a topic of a lot of discussion right now. Harvard Business School has created a new course very recently, and it's the idea of the social purpose of the firm. You know, it's a hot topic of discussion, partially because of all the events in the past 4 years, partially because of the mindset of Gen Z, who is a generation that tends to hold firms more accountable. And partially because I think that if we believe that the private sector is a better way to do things that are good for society, maybe we should think about the role of the private sector, not just in terms of generating profit, but in how they contribute. And I think that as a leader of a company, so you're left with two questions. The first one is how and how much you should engage with creating, not being accountable, not just to your company or shareholders, but the whole society. And then what are some of the decisions once you've figured out the level of engagement that you want to have? So I'd like to start maybe to give some context to our listeners about what is the social purpose of the firm? What was the thinking that led to the creation of that in the school? And then what are you hoping to achieve with the students that come through?
Sure. So this is very much an experiment in the making, but an exciting one. So just to step back one step for people who aren't familiar with Harvard Business School, the core of Harvard Business School is a two-year MBA program, but the entire first year is required. You have no options, Dino. As you'll recall, as a student, they don't call us the West Point of capitalism for nothing. You show up and we put you in a room with 90 people. We assign you a seat and we tell you exactly what you're going to do every day for the next 9 months. And then the second year is all electives. So when the dean and others asked me to oversee an initiative to think about the evolving role of business in society, there were a lot of things I wanted to do. But one of the things that was most important to me was that we get some material in the first year of the MBA program. Because what has historically been the norm at Harvard and other places is you do the important parts of business first. You do your marketing and your accounting and finance. And then you do things like thinking about climate change or thinking about purpose or thinking about making a difference. Those are kind of electives. And I felt really, really strongly, and I continue to feel really strongly, that at this moment in time, given the changes and the issues you talked about at the outset, it's critical for every business student and every business leader to think about this core question, this foundational question is, what is the purpose of the firm? Because the answer is not obvious or easy. And if we make thinking about that answer optional, we're not serving our own purpose, which is to educate leaders who make a difference in the world. So apologies for that long backdrop, but that was the backdrop against which we fought for and won the ability to put this new course in the first year. So it's right there along with marketing, accounting, finance, and the basics. And it's a short course. It's a pretty academic course, but we've taught it for 2 years now. And thus far, it's done quite well. We don't have it exactly right yet, but we're getting there. And it is designed, it doesn't have 2x2 matrices. It doesn't have super neat frameworks. It's designed to get the students early in their careers to really wrestle with this question, why was the firm created? And one of the central cases in the course, as you and others may know, everything we teach at HBS is in the context of a case. So there's no textbooks or anything. But one of the central cases is on the Dutch East India Company, founded in 1602. So not the company you think about when you're, you know, thinking about problems of the corporation today. But it's critical because the Dutch East India Company was not only the most valuable company of all time, it was the first corporation. It is a joint stock corporation. And even though it made so much money, it actually was not formed for the purpose of making money. It was formed as an arm of the Dutch government. And it's critically important for our students to understand that. And I think for modern business people to grapple with that. Because the corporation as we know it today was formed for a very different social purpose than the one we presume to be true. It wasn't formed to maximize profits. You know, the royal we here decided that profit maximization was the purpose of the firm relatively recently. And that's not to say that the Dutch East India Company had it right. In fact, they were one of the most hideous and horrendous monsters of all time. But what we want the students to realize is that the corporation did not descend from the heavens. It is not a natural creation. It is something that we humans have created. We can recreate it. We can rethink it, but we need to examine it. What should the corporation do? And I will stop talking in a moment, but you know, just to put out a couple of options, it is perfectly reasonable to say, as Milton Friedman famously did, that the only purpose of the corporation is to maximize profits. And yet it turns out if you read even a little bit of Friedman, even he is much more nuanced than that. But the broader context in which he's arguing that is that corporations max profit because he sees that as the best way for them to actually contribute to the public good. And he also sees a number of contexts in which the corporation or the private firm acting on its own, in fact, will not maximize public good and may cause problems for the public good. And this is where the economics gets a little bit wonky, but important. There are some parts of the world. Let's think about the water market, which is something we cover in the course, where the market looks like what the economists call a natural monopoly. You don't want 17 companies fighting to provide you with your water. You want one company. And it turns out that you probably don't want that company to be maximizing profits, because if there's only one company delivering your water, and water is the most critical necessity for all human beings, you want that company delivering water at a price that you and everybody else in the world can afford. So pure competition, pure profit maximization isn't going to work in the water market. It has to be something else. So that's just one example of several that we show. But we're trying to have tough cases, which really make the students, and it certainly made the faculty, think about how we think about the firm.
One of the most fascinating things of the case method is the fact that you hope or to know, or after, you know, maybe after you've taught a class 6 or 7 years, you have a sense of where a lot of students are going to fall, but there's always some surprise. I have to imagine in the first 2 years, you had a lot of surprises and things that students, positions that they came up with, and what they say. What are some of like the things that you have learned from the student going through the process of teaching them about thinking about the role of the firm?
Well, first of all, as you said, we've only had 2 ups at bat. So we're still figuring it out. But I think the first pleasant surprise was we got less pushback than we thought we would. You know, because this stuff is not what you're expecting in the first year of the MBA program, and we can't put it in a neat 2x2 matrix, we thought we'd get more pushback. Why are we doing this? This is too fluffy. You know, this is too woke. Pick your criticism. We actually got very little of that. In fact, what I got in my class this year, insofar as the students were complaining, they wanted more cases on governments. They wanted more cases on nonprofits. They wanted other examples of actors other than firms addressing these issues, which we're not going to quite do because that's not the purpose of the course. But I thought it was really, really interesting. They also wanted, and it's something we're struggling with, what we're trying, they really wanted us to continue the through line on purpose. So to be thinking about not only the purpose of the firm, but the purpose of themselves. They really wanted more information, advice, guidelines on how can I as an individual make an impact on the world? And, you know, I don't think that's a question that any course can provide an answer to. I think this is fundamentally a question that every individual has to stumble through on their own. But I don't think we would have heard that 20 years ago. I don't think we would have heard that 10 years ago. I think the generation that's coming through now, they're really worried about climate change. They're really worried about pandemics. They're really worried about inequity. And they want the firm to be the channel through which they can address those problems. But they really want guidance on how to do that. And I think that's the burden on us. Again, not that we're going to come up with the answers, but can we start learning more that we can share with them over time?
There's a lot of debate on how different is this generation, how more cuddled they are, how woke they are. But the reality is that whether we like the way that this generation behaves or not, they are going to be the majority of the workforce. So the leaders who are going to be effective leaders are leaders who know how to maximize and optimize this generation. What are some of the questions that somebody like me, older Gen Xer or even middle-aged Gen Xer, should ask themselves as they think about how to tackle this generation, and specifically within the context of matching the purpose of the firm with the purpose of the individual?
Yeah. So I may answer that sort of around the edges. I think this is a wonderful generation coming through. You know, I think they're ready to be engaged. You know, they want to solve problems. They want to be, you know, part of creating a better future. They're angry, maybe not so much at your generation. They're definitely angry at my generation because we blew it. You know, we thought it was the end of history and the Cold War was over and we were just going to keep marching on to utopia. And that has not proven to be true, alas. But what I see them struggling with is, first of all, this is the generation that was raised on social media. They had an iPhone in their hands from the time they had hands. And I think they realize the extent to which they were shaped and in some ways harmed by that. So image is super important and complicated. they're not very good at managing conflict. I don't mean to be critical, but if you're raised in an environment where you swipe left and swipe right, kind of on everything, you know, from restaurant reviews to dates, it's very hard to actually sit down and engage in dialogue. And we throw out easy terms like learn how to have a difficult conversation. But this generation really is not very good at having difficult conversations. No one's good at having difficult conversations. That's why they're difficult. But this is a generation that's had fewer of them. And we're seeing that, sadly, across campuses and across the United States right now around Israel Hamas, that, look, this is a nightmare situation regardless of your viewpoint. But we're getting, you know, protests that aren't even talking to one another, that aren't engaging. So I think anything managers can do to understand that it's not that these people don't want to engage, they desperately want to engage. This was also the generation that, you know, came of age during COVID, and, you know, they just lacked some social experience. They're desperate to engage, but they actually don't know how to do it. And interestingly, I see this not only with my students, but my daughter is a high school teacher. And, you know, she's just seeing her students who spent middle school in the pandemic. Now, our students in business school and, you know, young employees are obviously older, but they're not that much older. They spent critical developmental years stuck on Zoom. It's not that these muscles are, you know, completely atrophied, but they're not strong yet. So I think anything companies and bosses and mentors and friends and parents can do to practice that those muscles of engagement and dialogue and debate is really, really important.
That's fantastic. So I want to go back to the social purpose of the firm. Are there places where you address the fact that there are situations where choosing the better social purpose, if you will, can then result in also higher profitability? And how can manager think about that part of the equation, if you will?
Yeah. So let me give you kind of two levels of answer. The first is there's lots and lots of research. It's not research I've done, but it's research that numbers of my colleagues have done that shows you that firms that have a purpose do better than firms that don't have a purpose. And that's not really about being woke or progressive. It's about, I mean, just think about the basics. If you come to work in the morning and you don't know what the purpose is, you're not going to be running a very good company. So if the company has a purpose, if the organization has a purpose, if that purpose is clear and it's well articulated and there's metrics that lead you to that purpose, those organizations perform better. That's kind of easy. What we look at the course, and this is something we actually have to clarify because the word purpose is an amorphous word. It means lots of things to different people. We're looking at firms that not only have a purpose, but are trying to attack a massive societal problem through the vessel of a firm. So your purpose could be to build a better fountain pen. That's a fine purpose, and the better you articulate that purpose, probably the better pen you'll build. We're not talking about those firms. And that doesn't mean they're bad firms. It's just that you don't need this course to understand those firms. You need marketing and accounting and the basics. We're talking about firms that, and leaders in particular, individuals who have said there's a problem out there. And the clearest one is climate change. You know, if you said, as many people do, not only in Gen Z, but everywhere, gosh, climate change is the existential problem of our era. How can I go about it? Well, there's lots of ways you could go about it. You could be an activist. You could be a philanthropist. You could pick up litter on your street. You can turn off all your lights. There's lots and lots of ways to, as an individual, to try to attack climate change. We're looking at these particularly audacious and possibly crazy, or, you know, there's some element of crazy and of arrogance. These people who say, I'm going to try and attack climate change at scale. And I'm going to create a firm to be part of the solution. And we're looking at what it takes to make that happen. And these are not meant to be happy fairy tales because it's tough. They're meant to be complicated stories. And the case we start with, which is kind of the happiest and the clearest story, is this case that of a company that I'm a huge fan of called Northvolt. It's a Swedish electric battery maker. It's started by a couple of entrepreneurs, investors, and who care fundamentally about climate change. And they've now created a series of companies to attack climate change at scale with multi-billion dollar investments. And they're happy stories, but they're complicated stories. And what we're trying to pull out are the lessons. You know, for example, if you're going to be in this space, you'll have a competitive advantage if you are operating in an environment where the regulations push in the same direction you want to go. So one of the reasons it was easier to do an electric battery plant in Sweden than it might have been in Mexico, sort of somewhat unfairly pick a country, is Sweden is a country that where the government, both the Swedish government and the EU government, were trying to push people to buy greener cars. What's one of the ways you make a car greener? You make a greener battery. So there were subsidies in place. There were incentives in place. There were tax breaks in place. So it was easier to create a financial model that would work in Sweden than it might have been in another country. So again, if you're just making a better pen, you don't really need government rules. You don't have to worry about the regulation so much. If you're in an area where you're trying to attack a massive societal problem, almost by definition, you're going to have to worry about government. You're going to have to work with government. You're going to have to lobby government. And some of that is happy and some of that is messy. And some of that will put you in situations where you have to do bad things or things you don't want to do. And those are the kinds of problems that we're trying to unpack in this course. We're not trying to say to people, find a purpose, save the world, and make money. I mean, sometimes that works, but it's much more complicated than that.
You said there's a very complex issue. What are some of the things for somebody who is thinking that they would like to go and lead sort of in that space? What are some of the questions they should ask themselves?
Well, almost by definition, doing these kinds of businesses is much riskier than, you know, our basic alternative example is starting a lemonade stand or, you know, a restaurant. You're going to have to work with government. And that gets complicated. You know, one of the other companies we focus on is a water company in the Philippines. You cannot deliver water without working with the government. And in places where governments are weak or bad or corrupt, which sadly is the case in many parts of the world, at some point, you're going to be put in a position of having to work with a corrupt government, or as happens to this company, find yourself actually being physically threatened by the government. This is a much more complicated set of business relationships. Another problem that we look at is, and again, this gets a little academic, but it's, I think, really important. To what extent are you going to have to collaborate with other companies in your area? So, for example, we do a case on responsible AI. Hugely important problem. Like, who is going to write the rules of AI? And almost certainly no firm can do it on their own. And we've seen it play out in AI over the past, you know, 12 months. You know, if Microsoft decides that they're not going to use the AI to do certain kinds of things, but Google decides that they will, Microsoft is a private company. They're responsible to shareholders. They're going to have to kind of follow Google's path. And so what you really want, it's a classic race to the top rather than a race to the bottom. You want Google and Microsoft and OpenAI and Anthropic and all of these firms to kind of agree that, gee, we're all going to make sure, to use the easiest example, that there will be no child pornography that can be generated by AI or terrorist information. But you have to cooperate with your competitors. And, you know, I started my academic career a million years ago looking at commodity cartels. Turns out cartels don't work because you're trying to cooperate with your competitors and it almost never works. And yet in these areas where you're, it's almost by definition, if you're asking private firms to solve massive societal problems, they can't do it on their own. They're going to have to cooperate. And this is not kumbaya, hold hands and sing songs cooperation. It's how do we make deals that are good for all of us, that help us generate money, that don't get us in trouble and aren't illegal. And it's really hard to do that.
So if I were to summarize what you told me about somebody who wants to lead in an era where they're going to change the world through the business, they need to be a little crazy.
Yes.
They need to have a huge appetite for risk. They need to have patience for the government. And they need to be willing to play nice with others, or somewhat nice.
I wouldn't say nice. What I would say is they have to have a very systematic way of thinking about collaboration, almost the way similar to the ways in which corporations right now think about their supply chains, right? Because these two are collaborations of a sort. And we don't think about people, you know, being nice to their suppliers to be nice to their suppliers, but you're investing in long-term relationships. And so this is now, if you will, thinking about long-term relationships that are horizontal rather than vertical. It also turns out in most of these areas, again, almost by definition, you have to raise billions and billions of dollars. These are not companies that are, you know, doing this with you know, a little bit of spare change from friends and family. Our example of Northvolt, the capital raised for the factory they built was $8 billion. We, you know, where if you're looking at, you know, one of the huge issues with OpenAI or with AI in general is, as we're learning, these models are billions, if not at some point trillions of dollars. So you're going to have to find ways of raising massive amounts of capital for projects that, again, by definition, are untested and uncertain. Most people don't have the stomach or the network or the skills or the vision to do that. So the characters who can do this are very special birds. And this too is one of the questions that we want the students to struggle with, is that most people aren't going to want to do this.
You're reading my mind, because my next question was, all this is fascinating and all this is great, but all these points at a very small percentage of the people, but every year, 800 to 1,000 students are going through the first year of Harvard Business School. They're going through this class. And these are people that some of them are going to be entrepreneurs. Some of them may go to nonprofit. Some of them are going to be investment banker, investment managers, consultants, managers at companies. So what do you want that larger segment, if you will, of the class to take away from their experience with the social purpose of the firm? And then for those of us in general who, you know, raising a business world that did not ask this type of questions, but are still in the business world, what are some of the questions that we should be asking ourselves?
Well, sorry to keep talking about this company, Northvolt. I can talk about some of the others as well. But one of the things that the founder of that company has impressed upon me is that as an individual, it's really, really helpful to say, not how can I solve the problem, but how can I be part of the solution? And that, you know, to be honest, is part of my inspiration for putting this course together and for putting this broader program together. You know, I can't solve climate change. You know, I'm not a chemist. I'm not a physicist. I'm not a, you know, business person. I can't create any of the technologies. But gee, you know, I have the honor and the luxury of teaching at a wonderful business school that churns out, you know, 900 kids a year. If one of those kids, you know, can be part of the solution, that's my way to be part of the solution. One of the things we talk about with this battery company again, and it's, as you'll recall, with, you know, good cases have gotchas. You know, you ask questions that nobody can answer, but you know there's an answer. We ask, well, Jesus, how are they going to get 2,500 people to move to the Arctic Circle, where it's dark all the time, to work for a business where they're not going to get paid very much in Sweden, the wages are capped, and the chances are good it's not going to work. Well, it turns out that they've had absolutely no problem hiring, because there are tons of young people who love the idea of working on something that's visionary and planet-altering. So businesses don't run just on the one person at the helm. They run on the thousands of people who do their jobs inside the business. There are students who I'm sure will come out of the course or, you know, saying, gee, I don't want to be part of the business world. I want to be the activist here. And the activists have a big role to play. I really hope And what I think I'm starting to see it in our students here, again, regardless of the course, this is just the demographic trends. We're seeing more of our students, not a lot, but more saying, you know, I want to go work in the Department of Commerce for a number of years. Like, I think it's really important that we get the policy right. We had an event in Washington 2 weeks ago where we were looking at the IRA and the CHIPS Act. Most of the key policymakers working in the White House on the CHIPS Act are HBS grads. Who knew? And so we want, and I don't mean to sound too Pollyanna-ish here, it goes against my nature, but the world's in a pretty perilous state right now. We have massive polarization in this country. I've never since seen the partisan divide anywhere bad as it is right now, not to mention what's happening in the international sphere. If we can teach students to at least think about the importance of collaborating across sectors, again, not just holding hands and singing kumbaya, but how do we put policies in place and get popular support for them and get business to respond to incentives and have the public, you know, eager to purchase the goods that are produced as a result? We can start to think about these things societally. It doesn't mean we all have to agree and it doesn't mean we all have to play the same roles, but at least thinking about and getting excited about. There are problems out there. How can I, with my unique skills and talents and flaws and preferences, be part of the solution, even if I'm not the one or two very atypical individuals who are driving it?
Well, I think this is the perfect way and the perfect question to let people with. Thank you so much for coming and talking about this with me and with my audience. It's great to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, find a friend who may like it and tell them that they should listen to it. Also, you may have listened to every single episode so far, in which case I'm really thankful. But most likely you haven't, so go find a few others and listen to them. And if you really like the show, tell your friends and post about it on social media. Every little bit helps. Make sure you're subscribed to the show on your favorite listening platform so you don't miss any episode. If you listen on a platform that allows reviews and ratings like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, Good Pods, please leave us a stellar rating and a review. 5 stars. Stay tuned, because after the credits, I will play a song by Susan Cattaneo, one of Boston's best Americana singer-songwriters. For more information on the episode and all the links, go to the website al4ep.com, spelled with the number 4. You can email me at dino@al4ep.com. Make sure you follow the podcast on whatever social platform you use. On Twitter and Instagram, the handle is @al4edp, spelled with the number 4 and the letter D. And on Facebook, look for Authentic Leadership for Everyday People. This episode was produced by me, Dino Cattaneo. It was recorded remotely with Squadcast, and it was edited by Pro Podcast Solutions. The theme music was composed, produced, and arranged by Nicholas Cattaneo, who also played keyboards and drums with Tony Savarino on guitar and Jesse Williams on bass. And now here's a song by Susan Cattaneo. It's called Time and Love and Gravity from her record All Is Quiet. Love is worthy.